Good morning. Today is Thursday, January 8th, and welcome to The Bridge, a weekly news magazine produced by Coast Community Radio. I'm David Paul. On today's program, reporter Amanda Peacher looks at the state of hunger in Oregon. Rowan Moore Garrity will visit a deeply divided Catholic congregation in Yakima. Tom Bonsey looks at the fight over dredging on the Lower Snake River. An Idaho firm has the go-ahead to use drones in agricultural applications. And the University of Oregon Ducks will be playing in college football's inaugural championship game on Monday. Nearly 15 years ago, Oregon had the highest rate of hunger in the nation. The state changed a number of policies to try to help, but the percentage of people facing hunger today is nearly as high as it was in 2000. Amanda Peacher talked to Tiffany Warner, an Oregonian who depends on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Good morning. Today is Thursday, January 8th, and welcome to The Bridge, a weekly news magazine produced by Coast Community Radio. I'm David Paul. On today's program, reporter Amanda Peacher looks at the state of hunger in Oregon. Rowan Moore Garrity will visit a deeply divided Catholic congregation in Yakima. Tom Bonsey looks at the fight over dredging on the Lower Snake River. An Idaho firm has the go-ahead to use drones in agricultural applications. And the University of Oregon Ducks will be playing in college football's inaugural championship game on Monday.
There's a good chance you know someone in Tiffany Warner's position. Like one out of every five Oregonians, she receives SNAP benefits, commonly known as food stamps.
I'm 30 years old. I have three kids, and I work part-time at Goody's Chocolate downtown.
Tonight, she's serving mac and cheese and pizza bagels to her family. Warner used her SNAP benefits to buy ingredients. She can't imagine how she'd feed her family without that $500 monthly support.
Oh, I don't even know. That would suck. It would really suck.
Statistically, families like hers are more vulnerable to being food insecure or hungry. The USDA determines food insecurity by a number of measures, including whether households run out of food or whether people went without eating for more than 24 hours. About 15% of Oregon families were food insecure last year.
Being a single parent, I think it makes it super hard.
According to the USDA, households headed by single moms experience the most food insecurity of any in Oregon. When Warner applied for SNAP benefits, it was easy. But that might not have been the case a few years ago. In 2000, Oregon had the highest rate of hunger in the nation. This is then-Governor Ted Kulongoski back in 2003.
When 50,000 children every day go to bed, 50,000 children go to bed not having eaten a meal in the last 24 hours, that is not the Oregon I know.
Kulongoski convened a task force to address the crisis. Patty Whitney Wise, director of Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon, was involved from the start.
One of the areas that we had heard from the food bank that was of concern is that people coming to get food boxes were having a hard time getting food stamps.
So Oregon made it easier. The state required fewer reports and made the application user-friendly. It hired outreach workers across the state to educate people about SNAP.
That's probably one of the biggest success stories over the years.
Today, Oregon ranks second in the nation for SNAP participation. So most Oregonians who are eligible for SNAP get the benefit. And before the recession, hunger decreased. The primary reason?
Getting all those additional families onto the food stamp program.
Again, Patty Whitney Wise. So do Oregon's policy changes add up to fewer people at risk of hunger? Patty Whitney Wise believes there are fewer kids going to bed with empty bellies today than there were in 2000. The Oregon Food Bank Network has added 130 new food pantries since then. But she says SNAP and food banks aren't long-term solutions to poverty. Tiffany Warner says it's hard for her to accept that she needs SNAP or the occasional food box.
It's
in 2000,
nice
Oregon Public
there,
Broadcasting's
like
Rob Manning spoke with Portlander Tara Lynn,
like
who struggled to feed her family and relied on food stamps.
The Bethlehem Inn,
this fall,
donated
Amanda Peacher reconnected
to
with Lynn to find out whether her situation
like
has changed
like
more than a decade later.
I'm now one of those needy families, and I don't know. It's just kind of hard to, I guess, accept that.
Oregon no longer has the ranking as the state with the highest rate of hunger. The state now ranks 17th. But that's because other states are now worse off when it comes to hunger. Amanda Peacher, reporting. Life was hard for Tyra Lynn 12 years ago. Her husband had just lost his job, and the then 27-year-old mother of three had a hard time making ends meet.
And I'm walking down the street at the bus stop, okay? Digging in the trash can. putting the bottles and cans in my stroller so that I could take them to 7-Eleven and buy a loaf of bread or, you know, whatever it is I might need, you know, roll toilet paper.
It's been almost 15 years. It's just kind of hard to think about.
Now 39, Tyra Lynn still lives in Portland. She agreed to meet outside a coffee shop and listen back to what she had to say then.
I'm kind of done with, you know, it's kind of depressing because we're pretty much in the same situation, you know.
Today, Lynn lives in a two-bedroom rental home with her son Killian, now 13, and 17-month-old baby Hogarth. It's hard to sum up a decade, but when Killian was a baby, things were really tough. Here's how she described it back then, when seven people were staying over for the holidays and she needed milk.
And I took the last of the money I had, I mean, you know, the change jar, dumped it all out, and I went and bought a gallon of milk so that Killian, he was over a year old, so that he could have milk. And I swear it was not here for 2 hours and it was gone, and I just freaked out, you know. I guess I should have communicated to everybody that that was for the baby and for no one else, you know.
In the intervening years, the food bank and food stamps helped keep her family from going hungry.
You know, there's been some ups and downs. We just got our first food box, I think, 6 months ago after, you know, like 5 years of not needing those resources.
A couple years went well. She started college and her husband made a good wage, but then he got sick.
He had a tumor that was in a really compromising place. So.
He had 9 surgeries in 5 years. Lynn supported their family of 4.
5-6 years, I was the, you know, the sole breadwinner.
She worked at a food co-op, but lost that job earlier this year. Now, she works part-time for $15 an hour, serving samples at grocery stores. Even when she was working full-time, there were months when she didn't know how she'd make rent. At one point, their family was homeless. She and her husband separated in 2011.
I've been on food stamps my entire adult life.
Was there ever a time when she thought she wasn't going to make it?
Yeah. I mean, that's like a reality every day sometimes.
Even 12 years ago, Lynn said she couldn't see a clear path out of poverty.
I mean, it's not that I'm not looking for a way out. I just don't, I don't see it. I mean, every day I see, you know, I gotta do this today to get by. I gotta do this tomorrow to get by, but I can't really tell you what I could do today to make sure that a year from now, I'm not in this same position.
Today, it's hard for Lynn to listen back to herself all those years ago.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same.
Tara Lynn's sister, Constance Lee, has a different take on accepting SNAP benefits. Amanda Peters spoke with her.
I can't stop trying.
When we ended our story 12 years ago, we said that Lynn lives paycheck to paycheck, or food stamp to food stamp. Today, that's still true. Amanda Peacher reporting. Tyra Lynn is rolling pie dough in her sister's kitchen in Mountain Home, Idaho.
We're going to need more flour. I got barely enough flour for one more pie.
She's visiting from Portland for Thanksgiving, and she's taking charge of her sister's kitchen.
It's very typical of Tyra. She gets in the groove of things and doesn't let anybody help.
Sorry.
That's Constance Lee, Lynn's younger sister. The two are a decade apart in age, but very close.
And we talk almost every day on the phone. And most of what we talk about is how we had to do this or that to get what we needed, you know, how just the extremes that you have to go to.
Both sisters are working, but low income. They support each other however they can. At 16, Constance Lee lived in Portland with her sister. This year, when Lynn's 12-year-old son Marley struggled with school, Lee moved him to Idaho to live with her. And over the years, Tyra Lynn has been a role model and teacher to her younger sister. But there's one thing Constance Lee didn't pick up from her sister. Tyra Lynn gets SNAP benefits, but Lee doesn't, even though she'd probably qualify on her income.
I have a weird emotional conflict with state assistance.
Growing up, their family relied on disability and food stamps. Their mom had an eye disease that caused gradual blindness.
I remember the actual paper food stamps. And I remember being so embarrassed to use it. I never wanted to be seen with the food stamp card, you know.
The oldest of 5 kids, Tyra Lynn grew up watching her mom scrimp for their family. Lynn has no qualms about using SNAP now. Her income has almost always been below the poverty line. She recently told her 19-year-old son, River, that he should apply for benefits. He assumed he wouldn't qualify because he was working part-time. She told him,
go apply. Just the worst thing they can say is no. It could be just $50 in food stamps. You can't just let that go by.
Lynn has told her sister the same thing. But Constance Lee resists the idea. As a young adult, when Lee started earning enough to be self-sufficient, it was a big triumph.
I didn't have food stamps. You know how incredible that was? I didn't need it. I wasn't going to get it. And it was great.
But circumstances are different now. She works nights and her husband works days, so they don't have to pay for childcare. They're both full-time. But it's hard to meet expenses for their five-person household on about $2,500 a month.
I just did bills yesterday. I got paid yesterday, and after bills are paid, I have $162 for the next 10 days.
With a family to feed, her resistance to being on SNAP is softening. She's aware of what it could mean for her kids.
And if that means not having to limit, you know, they're three boys for crying out loud, not having to limit what they can have for after school snacks, it's worth it, you know? I'm not too proud, like, hungry will take your pride away real quick, you know? I think I just want so bad, because I remember how good it felt to not need it. And I just
people who
so
live in urban areas usually have a grocery store or a food pantry option within a few miles. But in rural communities, access to groceries with affordable fresh food is hard to come by. Amanda Peacher spoke with Marianne Duffy of Jordan Valley, Oregon.
Marianne Duffy stands at her kitchen stove with an apron on, sautéing ground beef.
Everything I'm using today, I got from the food pantry.
Her family of three lives in a trailer in Jordan Valley, a remote, high desert community in eastern Oregon. Her husband is disabled, so the family gets by on disability assistance and Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits, or SNAP. Tonight, Duffy is cooking stroganoff.
Usually they have sour cream in it, but I'm just putting cream of mushroom soup in it with the hamburger and a little seasoning over some macaroni noodles.
Sour cream is expensive, and Duffy has to be careful how she spends her $270 monthly SNAP benefits. It's the middle of the month when food starts to run low. Getting groceries is a day-long event for Duffy, like many rural residents on SNAP. She drives more than an hour to the Walmart in Nampa, Idaho.
You only can go shopping once a month. You have to do with what you got.
Duffy technically could use her SNAP benefits at Mrs. Z's, the one convenience store in town.
It's expensive. It's C-store expensive.
That's Leanne Conroe. Her family owns Mrs. Z's. She says the costs of operating a rural business are reflected in her store's food prices. A gallon of whole milk rings up at $5.50.
Basic C-store stuff. You can get a head of lettuce, but you're not going to buy a red pepper or a green pepper.
The Oregon Food Bank runs a mobile food pantry that visits Jordan Valley once a month. Without her food box, Duffy says her family would run out.
Always want more. Always want more. But I make it work. I do. And I think living here has taught me that.
30% of people on SNAP are employed, at least part-time. But in rural Oregon, wages tend to be low.
I live in rural Oregon, and I love it.
Deb Gusev lives alone in Gilchrist, central Oregon, and works in an electronics shop. She gets about $50 a month in SNAP. She says relatives who live in cities tell her she should just grow her own food. But even growing potatoes at high elevation in the desert is hard.
If you work, then when you get home, you're going to be out there in the dark with a flashlight between your teeth trying to find that stuff before it rots or something eats it. You just have to get out there and do it. And it makes you feel like some homesteader story. The people out there, you know, with frozen hands picking frozen potatoes.
Those potatoes might be a staple all winter. At the end of the month, right before her SNAP is recharged, Gusev says she's often hungry. Her dinners become simple.
Butter and salt and spaghetti noodles. And you kind of feel bad because that's just carbs.
In a small town, it's easy for neighbors to see each other's habits. In rural Oregon, there's strong pride in self-sufficiency. And some people are skeptical about those who seek government assistance.
There is definite suck-off-the-government mentality.
Again, that's Leanne Conroe, owner of Mrs. Z's in Jordan Valley. She says, at the same time, people are generous in the community.
This little place has five churches, maybe six. You know, that's a whole bunch of Christians. They want to help their neighbor.
Back in her trailer home, Marianne Duffy is seasoning that homemade stroganoff while her 11-year-old son stands by.
Dinner's almost ready, buddy. I know you're hungry, huh?
Duffy says she's sometimes criticized by neighbors for living on public assistance. She says it doesn't get to her.
They are not in my shoes. They have no idea what goes in my house. And we try to live the best way we can. We've always worked till now, and We were hard workers.
She says she doesn't rely on SNAP because she wants to. She does it because she has to. Amanda Peacher, reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio 91.9 KMUN in Astoria, 89.5 KTCB in Tillamook, and we're streaming live on the web at coastradio.org. You can listen on your mobile device by using the TuneIn app. In today's weather, partly cloudy skies, highs 50 to 55, nighttime lows around 40. Partly sunny tomorrow, maybe some rain tomorrow afternoon with highs 45 to 50. Nighttime lows again in the lower 40s. Heading into the weekend on Saturday, slight chance of rain Saturday morning. That's going to increase over the course of the day. Highs will be around 50, nighttime lows around 40. And then Sunday, rain is likely, highs 45 to 50 degrees. Lewiston, Idaho has had unusual bragging rights for the past 40 years. It's the farthest inland seaport on the West Coast, 465 miles upriver from the Pacific Ocean via the Columbia and Snake Rivers. The viability of the Port of Lewiston depends on regular dredging of the Snake River. But on November 24th, environmental and fishing groups and the Nez Perce tribe went to federal court to stop plans to dredge beginning in December. Correspondent Tom Bonzi reported grain barges were running aground amidst all the bickering.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, along with port officials in Lewiston and Clarkston, described dredging of the Snake River planned for next month as an urgent need. Critics call it a boondoggle and a setback to salmon and lamprey recovery. Lewiston Port Manager David Doringsfeld says it's been nearly 9 years since the last dredging of the port berths and nearby navigation channel.
At this point, we're definitely overdue, and the need is critical at this point. The sedimentation is causing impacts and safety concerns where we need to dredge.
Doringsfeld says just about anywhere else, this modest maintenance project would not be news. But Idaho's only seaport is not just any old place. It's upriver of four Snake River dams, long in the crosshairs of some environmental groups. Environmentalists wrote to the Army Corps this fall that the best way to deal with sediment buildup around Lewiston and Clarkston would be to breach the downstream dams.
If we do have a sediment problem at this confluence, one way that the Corps did not study to move that sediment downstream would be to remove the impoundment downstream.
Dustin Ahern owns Idaho River Adventures, a whitewater rafting outfitter and guide company. He's allied with environmental groups, but Ahern prefers to make a business case against dredging here. He argues the multi-million dollar costs for dredging, lock maintenance, and government studies far outweigh the community benefits.
So we as the taxpayers, and not only the local Nez Perce County, Idaho, Soton County, Washington, but also folks in Seattle, Olympia, Portland, California, everywhere across the United States, end up chipping in to support this real small portion of our waterborne shipping.
The conservation camp and the port business interests have each enlisted economists to bolster or debunk the subsidy argument. Meanwhile, out on the river, it's getting harder to carry on business as usual. While Ahern and I talk on the Lewiston levee, a pair of transport barges take on wheat at a big grain elevator on the opposite shore. Arvid Lyons manages that operation, the Lewis-Clark Terminal.
We struck several barges at the berth here. We grounded a barge out in the turning basin at 13.4.
So 13 feet, 4 inches.
Correct. We've grounded, there's been a barge that grounded over by Clarkston on the edge of the channel at 13.4. And we've grounded barges in at our berth at Clarkston at 10 feet.
Grain moving downstream for export accounts for the great majority of commercial traffic on the lower Snake River. Environmental groups suggest this grain could go to market by rail instead. But Lyons says competition for space on the rails from rising oil train traffic presents a new argument for keeping the barge terminals viable.
The rail system is congested, and we're seeing more bushels, and we've had record years in the last couple years, some of our best years ever.
Besides cargo barges, the Lewiston-Clarkston Valley is also a destination for river cruise lines. The manager of the Port of Clarkston says further silt accumulation could put regular visits by three cruise ships in jeopardy in 2015. Now it falls to a federal judge to make a quick decision on the balancing of harms and the likelihood the critics will prevail at trial. A temporary injunction would likely delay any dredging by at least a year because the allowed in-water work window in winter is short. I'm Tom Bonzi in Lewiston, Idaho.
Meanwhile, just this week, the suit was decided in favor of dredging interests as a federal judge on Monday rejected the environmental and tribal challenge to dredging. Here's Tom Bonzi again to look at the decision.
Federal Judge James Robart made a one-sentence ruling from the bench after listening to several hours of arguments. He said environmental groups and the Nez Perce tribe failed to meet the tough test for an injunction. That means dredging of accumulated silt around the ports of Lewiston, Idaho, and Clarkston, Washington, can proceed starting next week. Dave Doringsfeld manages the Port of Lewiston.
We've had six different groundings in our area, right in within the confluence area, and you know it's imperative that we get this done before you know we have a severe grounding where it would have some, you know, maybe some environmental consequences.
An attorney for the environmental challengers said the Army Corps is throwing good money after bad by continuing to dredge the Lower Snake River. Steve Mashuda of the Earth Justice Law Firm said he'd wait for the federal court's written ruling before deciding what to do next. I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
A Boise area startup has become the first company to win federal approval to use drones in farm settings. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports the goal is to use small drones to help Northwest farmers grow crops more efficiently.
Advanced Aviation Solutions is co-owned by two Air Force veterans who retired to the inland Northwest and now has the green light to market a fixed-wing drone for use over farms. Company President Steve Edgar says the small drone can be equipped with a high-resolution camera to measure crop stress from overwatering, bad soil, or bugs.
If we can identify the stress early on and pinpoint it to a very high degree of accuracy, then the farmer can take corrective action early in the growth cycle to increase his yields.
The FAA put conditions in its approval letter that wouldn't apply to a hobbyist flying a similar-sized drone. The commercial drone operator must be a certified pilot, keep maintenance records, and be teamed with a ground observer. Several other Northwest companies, including Amazon.com, are still waiting for FAA approval to fly unmanned aircraft for their businesses. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
Washington law enforcement officials opened up a second basic training academy in Spokane on Tuesday. Police agencies are hiring more, and leaders hope changes in training will prepare them for modern-day issues. Spokane Public Radio's Paige Browning reports.
Law enforcement officials opened up a second basic training academy in Washington today in Spokane. Police agencies are hiring more, and leaders hope changes in training will prepare them for modern-day issues. Criminal Justice Training Commission Director Sue Rahr says there used to be less than 300 officers trained a year. Now it's up to 600. And as national discussion picks apart police training and use of force, Rahr asserts Washington State gives special attention to mental health.
We have added an 8-hour block of crisis intervention training, which specifically trains police officers to recognize mental illness, drug addiction, traumatic brain injury.
Rahr was recently appointed to President Obama's Commission on 21st Century Policing. She says the academy in Burien also has updated curriculum. The Spokane Academy has been closed since 2008, leaving all training to staff in Burien. At least 18 agencies will now send their recruits to Spokane, from as close as Liberty Lake to as far away as Aberdeen. In Spokane, I'm Paige Browning.
And as an old Oregon Duck, I couldn't resist this story. In a lead-up to the first-ever college football playoff national championship game, the Oregon Ducks gave members of the media some time this past week. A few key players gave interviews, then all mics pointed toward Heisman Trophy-winning quarterback Marcus Mariota. KLCC's Tiffany Eckert has this report.
Mariota says as a boy growing up in Hawaii, he dreamed of winning a national championship game. Now he has his chance.
You know, I'd trade the Heisman to win this. No disrespect, but yeah, I mean, just means a lot more because it's a team effort.
Ask any member of the Oregon Duck football team, and chances are you'll hear about the process. Mariota explains what it means.
Trusting each other, trusting win the day, trusting the next man up. And if you trust that, you know, the coaches will put you in the right spots. Really, all those things together is the process.
Duck coach Mark Helfrich prepares his team by recognizing how the Super Bowl of college football will be unlike any other game they've played.
The atmosphere will be totally different. The Ohio State, you know, legendary fan base, it'll be a different ratio of Oregon fans to Ohio State fans, and it's indoors. You know, that lends to a much more energized atmosphere.
Still, Coach Helfrich says the Ducks are ready to face the Buckeyes. The championship game is next Monday, January 12th. I'm Tiffany Eckert, reporting.
As one who endured the 1983 Civil War game in which Oregon and Oregon State battled to a 0-0 tie, the notorious Toilet Bowl, all I can say is unbelievable. And that's about all the time we have today. The Bridge is a weekly production of Coast Community Radio. I'm David Paul, inviting you to tune in next Thursday for another edition of The Bridge.